Let's talk. Talk. John Brown. Is this working? The jobs we do, told by the people who do them. They meet in coffee shops, chain pubs, or front rooms. Through hearing people tell their stories, Charlie Colnott found out the number of birds killed in a day in a poultry factory, the order in which patients are woken up in care homes, and the reasons why you shouldn't smile when you're shown your bonus in investment bank. It has been described as an intense and revealing interview, capturing the raw voices of people talking honestly about work. Charlie Colnott is the author of it, and I'm delighted to say that Charlie joins me on the line now. Charlie, good morning to you.
Good morning, Charles. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thanks. Is this working? I asked myself as I sit in a room and I talk to myself for a living, but there you go. What's your background, Charlie? What's your background, and B, what inspired you? What was the spark that got you behind this book?
Yeah, well, the two of the kind of rolled together, those questions, where I was a commercial lawyer and I started during the pandemic. And so I was working long hours, basically in my flat, and I was quite disillusioned with the choices I've made in terms of my career. And I wanted to sort of see what else was out there. I'd felt I'd made a big mistake in, you know, working all these hours, looking at these very boring documents, and I was going to have to do that for the next 30 years. So I wanted to get out there and talk to as many people as possible about what they did all day. And hopefully that would help me understand what I really wanted to do.
I mean, a lot of us sort of re-evaluated our lives during that time 5 years ago, of which we cannot talk. And the thing is, though, I mean, a lot of people go, yeah. And then they sort of went back to doing what they did because, hey, it's the wage at the end of it. How did you actually sort of physically go about it? Did you sort of rock up to somebody, excuse me, sir, may I ask you what you do? Because obviously you might end up with a sock in the mouth if you're lucky.
Yeah, it was a lot of that, actually. I hadn't really anticipated how much it would be like a kind of cold selling job where I was trying to speak to about 30 people and then maybe one of them would say, oh yeah, I'd love to be interviewed. But it was a mixture of going up to people in the street, contacting them online, ringing them up, saying, look, I'm doing this book about work. It's just people talking in their own words about what their job involves. Do you fancy it? And then I'd have to say, no, I'm not trying to scam you. Yeah. I promise.
I'm not from Her Majesty's Customs. This is actually a real thing.
Exactly.
So did you have any sort of preconceptions then before you started this? Because you're working as a commercial lawyer before that. So,
yes.
I mean, that's obviously, here comes the obvious question. That's your qualified position, etc. Did you have any idea of, not saying you didn't, Charlie, but of sort of working class lives, etc.? He said, trying to get out of a hole he just dug for himself. But there you go.
No, I see where you're coming from. I suppose beyond, there's quite a lot of journalism about, you know, going into Amazon warehouses and talking to people there and asking about what it's like. So I had a kind of rough idea about those kind of really difficult, precarious jobs. But what I think I was broadly interested in is that we often don't talk about the kind of boring middle that people, you know, the data analysts, the accountants, and that often the way we talk about work, it's focused on either the people that are earning loads and loads of money in the city, or it's the people who are working the Amazon warehouses. So I kind of wanted to go broad and boring, but hopefully the interviews aren't that. But yeah, I mean, some of the stuff I heard was absolutely really dispiriting. Like, I talked to someone that worked in those e-commerce warehouses that are all kind of staffed by robots.
Yeah.
And he stood on a tower. Another tower came up to him with a load of products. He would pick up a product, scan it, and then put it somewhere else. And he'd do that for 9 hours. And then every hour, on his little screen, it would say, would you like to take a 30-second break? You can either do physical exercises or mental exercises. And the mental exercise would be something like, think of a happy thought. And he would think, getting out of this place. So yeah, there were some really awful stories of where, you know, you don't have qualifications in that, and you take what job you can, and you're treated not very well.
But you see, this is the thing, because it's very sexy for politicians to say the gig economy, and you know, we can we can all be our own. You know, I remember something about the other thing we can't talk about in Spain, which is El Brexit, as we call it over here. I've Brexit to you. Was the fact that we would unleash our potential and be swashbuckling across the globe, but actually it's a zero-hour contract thing, and it is the sort of whilst it might sound all very exciting having, you know, a gig economy on your doorstep, it actually means that it can be mind-numbingly boring and frankly depressing.
Yeah, and there's a huge amount of, it's often a big red flag that I found in doing these interviews is where it's not quite clear who your employer is. So say you're working for one of these warehouses, there'll be an agency that gives you the job, but you'll also be paid by an umbrella company. And then you'll also have the company that runs the warehouse. So you've got three people, all of whom are kind of a bit like your employer, but you never really know who's responsible for paying your salary. And if you've got a complaint, who do you raise it with? And it's this really nasty system where all it means is that people don't really understand their rights and who they can enforce their rights against. It's, yeah, that'd be a big red flag. When it comes to the economy.
Here's the thing, because, you know, a family member of mine, she works in a factory. You know, she's happy with working in the factory. She, you know, she puts things on top of other things all day on a conveyor belt for, you know, 8 hours, 9 hours, whatever it is a day in various shifts up in North Wales. But there's a sort of camaraderie because they've been doing it together because she's a lady of a certain age now. They've been doing it together for like the past 20 years. So they'll go down to the bingo afterwards or play dots or karaoke, whatever they do. And, you know, if you're of my age, you remember all those sort of look and learn TV series where they used to have people, all the happy, because it was always women doing this thing, all the happy mums doing this, all happy women doing this in the shop factory and all the welders on the, you know, in Coventry on the, as car manufacturers or whatever. And it was repetitive, but there was a community, if you like, and they all went down the pub afterwards. Has that disappeared, do you think, Charlie? Have you found that? That people are now working sort of basically anonymously and autonomously, and they can't form bonds between each other because they don't know if they're going to be there the next week.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly it. And it comes back to this agency stuff, where if you're working for an employment agency and they've got a relationship with several employers, they could just offer you different, you know, 1 week you'll be somewhere and another week you're somewhere else. And of course, that suits the company because they don't want workers all kind of talking about things and organising and kind of doing all the stuff that the trade unions used to do. So, yeah, I mean, just in terms of raw numbers, the amount of people working in those kind of manufacturing jobs has, you know, absolutely gone through the floor. But yeah, also there's this agency angle that is taking away that people side of work, which, as you say, is really important, and it can make almost any job palatable. You know, soldiers, when they talk about their experience in Afghanistan and Iraq, it's always coming back to the camaraderie and brotherhood and things like that.
Yeah, it's fighting for their mates. So looking at, so that's, I mean, that's the sort of the downside, as it were, you know, there's the depression. But we don't, it's not a book that you make you think, oh, blimey, it's one of those bleeding heart liberal books, etc. Because there are stories in there as well of people who actually like really enjoy this, trade union leaders who, you know, despite the thing that say people are saying, oh, well, the people are, you know, in politics or whatever for themselves, but, you know, there's, you've got a trade unionist in there who does it for the cause and is inspired for that in that. So tell me a little bit about something like that.
Yeah, I mean, he was an interesting one in that I think it was a bit of an exception, actually, in that for most people, if you'd gone into a job in, say, a charity or the third sector, you do it for very good reasons. And then actually you find the reality of the job is a kind of business job like any other, where you spend most of your time answering emails and doing calls. And so quite a few people were disillusioned in that respect, but he really was fired up by the kind of potential for what trade unionism could be in the 21st century, where, you know, everyone could be organizing on phones and things like that. But yeah, I think I was really worried that the book was going to be a very kind of unhappy book, people just moaning as the British people are wont to do. But actually there are some quite kind of inspiring stories where it's often people that have had a kind of wandering journey where they'd left quite a few jobs and settled upon something they really found meaningful. So, for instance, there was a joiner, a carpenter, who had been at real rock bottom, where he was about $8,000 in credit card debt. He was working as a labourer for some not very nice builders, and he'd just had a baby. And he decided to basically teach himself how to do carpentry on YouTube and then take some jobs with the council. And every week he'd buy a new tool, which would allow him to do another job afterwards. And after several years, he'd cleared his debt and he was happy as Larry and had kind of given himself that autonomy and freedom. to kind of shape his working life to his wishes. But yeah, so I think that's a kind of lesson of it, that often we're so afraid to leave things because we think, oh gosh, it's going to be an absolute disaster if I do that. I know I'm not happy here, but think about what I have. But the lesson of the book is the people that do take those risks end up happy, even if they're, you know, if you're $8,000 in debt with a baby at home, that is a big risk to leave your job. And yeah, that I hope people reading it are inspired in that respect.
Well, the thing is as well, it just proves you that there is no, I mean, if you'd written this book 50 years ago, well, you wouldn't, because you've probably been, you know, weren't around, but if, you know, because 50 years ago, you know, you had a job when you left school at 18 or 16, and then you were in Italy, you tried at 65, you had a job for life. Yeah. That was the whole thing. And of course, you know, in today's modern marketplace, even in my line, trust me, I'm a freelance, you know, I mean, you just, you know, you do everything from bleeding, you know, your CV can include everything from, I don't know, from being a delivery driver to, you know, doing voiceovers. So there's no such thing. So the guy who reinvents himself as a carpenter, perhaps the thing is we all are going to have to reinvent ourselves. And I suppose if you want to change it, go for it, because the worst can happen is you just go back to where you kind of were.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, that's what the internet should have been, right? In that you can find out about almost any career, you can teach yourselves things that you never knew. And yet it's almost seemed to have the opposite effect, where it almost makes you too aware of all the downsides of doing something. Like, you Google, how do I become an X? And you see that you've got to get a qualification and you've got to do this and that. And so you don't take that plunge. But as you say, yeah, we should all be kind of taking the opportunities that come to us in that respect.
But the thing is, on this one, Charlie, is that the thing with the internet is one of my many gripes with the internet is the fact that because of, you know, TikTok, Instagram, the whole thing, you know, they all say, follow your passion. Well, fine. But if your passion is, I don't know, providing warm gloves for Natterjack toads, that might be your passion, but it ain't going to make a living out of it. So that's number one. And number two is, if your passion is something that you want to do, it's not going to happen overnight, and you've got to do the grind, as the saying goes. And I'm sure your book says that, but the problem is a lot of young people go, oh, well, I tried doing this for like 10 days, didn't work, so I'm not doing it anymore.
Yeah, the Brooklyn Beckham approach, I think, is. I think it's kind of a mistake we make, in that we don't really think about what the job actually is, and that is just a collection of tasks that we do all day. And so when we're thinking about the kind of what job would I like and what would I find rewarding, you should be thinking about what actual physical tasks do you get a kind of buzz after doing, rather than thinking, well, what is this job title? And does that kind of conform to some idea of, you know, my identity and dream and all that kind of stuff? Like, I imagine if you were to become an influencer or something like that, like, yeah, there's a kind of status to it and it looks great, but day to day, I'm not sure how rewarding it is to be taking thousands of photographs and editing and having to kind of put yourself out there, receive all that criticism and comment. So yeah, think about the task first would be another piece of advice.
Friends of mine who run hotels down here on the Costa del Sol in Marbella, they just say that, you know, as soon as they get a call from somebody saying I'm an influencer, that's the end of the call, basically, because it's like, nah, I've done that already. I don't want to hear from you people. If you're doing a job though, presumably you should do something that you don't have a guttural primary fear of. And there's a baker in here, and if you're going to be a baker, you're going to have to touch some bits and pieces, aren't you? And this one's got a, and I've never heard, there must be a Latin name for it, but he's got a fear of flour.
Yeah, that was very strange. I don't know. Yeah, I think he was working in a supermarket, and they have bakeries, and they'd said, do you want to be a baker? And he said, oh, you know, I'm a bit afraid of flour. But he saw that the bakers were having such an easy time of it compared to everyone else, rushing, you know, to and fro, trying to stack the shelves and fulfill orders and all that kind of stuff, that he thought, well, I should probably try and get over that. And now, you know, how many years later, he's still a baker working at an independent bakery this time. And he was very happy. I mean, that sounds like it's a hard job. The early hours, yeah, absolutely brutal. But you got four of your mates working alongside you and chatting all day. That can make those early hours feel well worth it.
Please tell me that you entitled that chapter, Feel the Flower, But Do It Anyway.
Yeah.
Well, but
too late now, John.
It's too late now. Well, the ebook maybe. And also, there's a story that you can take because people go, "Oh, well, there's no point in me trying to change anything because nothing ever changes." You know, I'm just an insignificant cog in the wheel. But there's a cleaner, isn't there? Who took the council to court and won. What's that one about?
Yeah, she was amazing. I mean, she started out as a carer, doing a domiciliary carer, so doing those sort of 24-hour shifts. Loved it, but then had a bit of a kind of breakdown because. You know, seeing people that you really care for die is just, you know, and that happening again and again can be extremely challenging. And then her doctor had said, "Why don't you go and do something you enjoy?" And so she said, "Well, I like cleaning." So she went out and bought a Hoover and a load of cleaning stuff, then packed her car and off she went. And then just kind of reinvented herself, really, and ended up running for a local government and getting elected. And she had, just was given this new sense of confidence where before she had been really, you know, down in the dumps about things. She, I think, had done a load of stuff in her local area, and everyone knew her as the kind of cleaner councillor. That was another inspiring story where, once again, you're at rock bottom. And it's only when you get to rock bottom that you decide to take that risk that you probably should have done a while ago.
What was the most sort of drop your bacon sandwich moment or jaw dropping moment? You went, what? You know, because there's a few people say things, you know, and it, you know, they say, you know, we just did that. And you go, you know, what do you mean you just did that? I mean, there are, you know, is it number of chickens, you know, dispatched per day, or is it the hours you get up? Or, I mean, there must be, you must have learned some things that have given you a completely different perspective on life. But what was the moment that you thought, I never knew that, and I'm glad I do now, or I wish I hadn't heard that sort of thing?
Yeah, so probably that one of the carers, he was saying that they're often short-staffed and they've got to wake up all of the patients by, say, 8 a.m. So each carer has to wake up 10 patients by then. And that's not much time. It's like an hour to do that. And you've got to get them washed and dressed and all of that stuff. And so what they end up doing is they start with the people who don't get visitors and the people that are most frail and are most far along in, say, dementia. Even if they're having to wake them up at 5 a.m. and they're screaming, they know that they're not going to complain to their relatives. And so their managers aren't going to get a load of stick. And the care home isn't going to get a load of stick. And to me, that was just, you know, it makes sense.
Yeah.
But it's dark and it's horrible. And it shouldn't, we've somehow designed a society where, we're so short of carers that they're having to rush it. And people are suffering as a result of that. And that is, absolute outrage in that front.
How did you put this all together in sort of a narrative? Because it's all very well having a bunch of stories in the whole thing, but otherwise it could be a real sort of, mix-up, a hodgepodge of various stories. So did you put themes through it? Or how did you actually come with it? Because you got all this stuff and then comes the hard bit, which is actually writing the thing.
Yeah, so I tried to group it in themes. So the chapters are things like body work, which is people who work with their bodies. So there's a cam girl, someone that repairs cars, and security guard, and then school work, which is, you can imagine what that is. And there's 20 or so of those chapters. But I kind of also wasn't afraid of the hodgepodge because there's a chapter called City Work, say, and that is a derivatives trader who earns loads of money in the city. And then I think the interview after that is with a cleaner that works in the city as well. So you can actually get some quite interesting contrasts by, not trying to stick too rigidly to some kind of theme. But, these people are working alongside each other, but they don't know it.
Did it make you, so when you've done it, has it made you appraise, you know, because you obviously took that break and stepped into the glamorous world of writing, and I salute you. But, did it make you reappraise having heard those stories about your own relationship with work and indeed everybody's relationship with work, really?
Yeah, I think it did. I mean, I also had a very delightfully, my wife gave birth to a daughter a year and a half ago. So the combination of doing this book and that has definitely made me think that I shouldn't be led by what other people think, which I think is probably quite a good lesson generally. That so often you can do things because they seem like the right things to do and because everyone else would look at it and nod and say, oh, yes, that's the right thing to do. And I think that's why I became a lawyer anyway. So I've been trying to think about what moments in my career have I really enjoyed? And these interviews have been that, but also the writing up and writing essays, and also any teaching that I've done. So I'm going back to uni to do a PhD in September. And hopefully that'll be the right combination of, you know, teaching students and having relationships, those kind of relationships with them, but also researching and writing. But we'll see how we go.
And plus the adventure as your little one hits the terrible twos, which will be as much fun as having.
She's already there, so I'm a bit worried about what that's going to look like.
The book is called Is This Working? The Jobs We Do, told by the people who do them. It's by Charlie Connett, who we're speaking to today. You can order it, by the way, and I urge that you do, via our own virtual bookstore. Charlie, if people want to find you online and say lovely things to you, where's the best place to find you?
On Substack. And my Substack's called The Administration of Things.
The Administration of Things. We like that. This book is called Is This Working? It's by Charlie Connett. Charlie, thank you so much for your time today.
Cheers, Charles. Take care.